Hello, everyone, and thanks for joining us. We're taking you live to the Lebanese capital, Beirut. The Secretary General of Hezbollah, Said Hassan Nasrallah, is speaking on this day, the International Quds Day. Let's all listen in.
And with the unfolding are being faced, which Al-Quds, Jerusalem, is facing and Palestine is facing, this stresses the importance of announcing this day. It stresses the importance of announcing this day 30 years ago and the importance on stressing on celebrating this anniversary or remembering Al-Quds even after Imam Khomeini passed away. And Imam Khamenei, may God preserve him, stressed on the importance of continuing to walk on the same path and to show the same commitment towards Jerusalem Al-Quds and towards Palestine and towards the conflict with the Israeli enemy and confronting the American Zionist plot in the region. There are always certain issues, whatever be the magnitude of these issues. There are always fears that time will kill these issues, just like we see in the judiciary. Not in the Islamic judiciary, but in the civil judiciary, sometimes they fear that as time passes, a certain cause may die. And we now are witnessing and we are facing a cause which is threatened by time. Time threatens to make this cause die. Time threatens to make this issue die because of international conspiracy. This cause is threatened by weakness and by despair. And so we are up against an issue with the magnitude of Jerusalem Al-Quds. But despite the magnitude of this cause, it could die down. It could die because of the time which is passing. However, our ummah or our nation cannot forget this cause, because this cause is part of our religion, part of our religious commitment. It's part of our culture. It is part of our civilization. It is part of our ethics. It is part of our past, part of our history, part of our present and future. And so we must remind, time and again, we must remind the whole world of this cause. We must remind everyone on all occasions. This issue must be present, this cause must be present in the conscience and in the minds of the ummah, in the programs, in the movements of the ummah, whether they be the governments or the peoples of the ummah. This is the central goal which Imam Khomeini meant when he announced Al-Quds Day. Al-Quds Day is a day whereby we stress and assure our principles. We don't announce our principles, we stress on these principles. These principles are well known, and many martyrs and many sacrifices were made for the sake of this cause. Many detainees were taken in, many houses were destroyed, many people were forced to leave their homes because of this cause. Today, the day of Al-Quds is a day whereby we stress on our principles, whereby we repeat righteousness. As in the holy month of Ramadan, we read once again the Holy Quran and we reread also the verses which we learned for 1,400 years. Al-Quds Day is a day where we repeat our principles to the whole world, and we say that the challenges and the dangers and the difficulties and the pains will not change one little bit our principles, although some have changed, although some have succumbed to the difficulties. Principles say, and our firm say, that Palestine from the river to the sea is the possession of the Palestinian people, the right of the Palestinian people, and the right of the Arab and Islamic people. And it is not the right of anyone. Nobody has the right to abandon one inch of the territory of Palestine. Nobody has the right to abandon one piece of soil of the holy territory of Palestine, or one drop of water of Palestine, nor to abandon one letter of the name of Palestine. Al-Quds Day is the day where we announce this ideological attachment, this ideological principle, this truth which we cannot deny. Anything else will be fabrication and lies, a fabrication of history and a fabrication of the facts. To announce that Al-Quds cannot be, not one street of Al-Quds, not one neighborhood in Jerusalem Al-Quds, not one neighborhood can be an eternal capital for a state named Israel. Al-Quds, Jerusalem, is the capital of Palestine, and as we said before, it is the capital of the land and the air, meaning that it is well known that Israel is an illegitimate state, an illegal state, an immoral, inhumanitarian state, a state or entity which is based upon stealing other people's territories, based upon killing and based upon massacres. And so this entity cannot take legitimacy, cannot be legitimate, regardless of who recognizes this entity, regardless of who says this entity exists. This is the logic of Al-Quds Day. This is the logic of righteousness. This is the logic of speaking in the right way, without any comments whatsoever, without any bowing down to the international situation, to the international conditions or circumstances, without bowing down or deterring to the terrorist logic which is used by those who have deterred to the international circumstances. Al-Quds Day is a day whereby we remind the whole world of our principles, and it is also a day, it is an international occasion to shed light on what Al-Quds is being subject to shed light on what Jerusalem Al-Quds is being subject to, and what Palestine and the people of Palestine are being subject to. It's also a chance to shed light on what the Al-Aqsa Mosque is being subject to, the dangers against Al-Aqsa and the dangers against Jerusalem Al-Quds as a holy city, a city with Islamic and Christian sanctities. Look at what is happening to the holy sites, Christian and Muslim holy sites. Look at what is happening to the inhabitants of Jerusalem Al-Quds, how territories are being stolen, how people are being forced to leave their homes. It's also a chance to shed light on what is happening to the West Bank, how settlement activity continues in the West Bank. Even the stupid negotiations which began yesterday have not put a stop to the settlement activity. It is a chance to shed light on what is going to the 1948 territories, American, Israeli, Western attempts to impose a Jewish state in the 1948 territories. It's a chance to shed light on what is going on in Gaza, what is going on and what the people of Gaza are subject to. The hunger, the siege, the oppression. It's a chance to shed light on what millions of Palestinians are being subject to, millions of Palestinians who were forced to leave their homes and leave their farms and forced to leave their countries. This is a chance to shed light on all of these topics and to put them under the international spotlight, under the Muslim and international public opinion and the Arab public opinion, so that everyone can take their responsibilities. Al-Quds Day this year coincides with two important events. The first event this year is the announcement of the so-called direct negotiations. In Washington. The second event is the American withdrawal from Iraq. Now, some called it a withdrawal, and some considered that this means that the American occupation of Iraq has ended, and this is not true. And some called it a partial withdrawal, and I believe that this is incomplete, and in this way we're not giving the right to the Iraqi occupation, because the Iraqi occupation played a role. So we can call it a half withdrawal or a three-quarter withdrawal. I think if we name it like this, we're giving we're appreciating the efforts of the Iraqi occupation, of Iraqi resistance, sorry. First of all, the direct negotiations were born dead. The American political taking advantage of this, and the American elections are very clear when it comes to negotiations. The Israeli need of these negotiations is very clear, and the Arab need for the negotiations, unfortunately, is very clear. The last side who is concerned with these negotiations is Palestine and the rights of Palestine, meaning these negotiations won't do anything for Palestine and the negotiation and the Palestinian people. These negotiations were born dead, and the majority of the Palestinian negotiations condemn these, the Palestinian factions condemn these negotiations. You know that we as factions in the Arab world, we have two points of view. Some people have a stance in principle against negotiations. In principle, they are against negotiating with the Israeli enemy. We are one of those factions. Some don't have a stance against the negotiations in principle. However, they speak about the timing of the negotiations and the conditions of negotiations. Even the factions who don't have a problem in principle with negotiations announce their rejection to these negotiations, and all of the opinion polls which were conducted by the media outlets for the Palestinian people showed that the majority of the Palestinian people announced their objection and their rejecting of these negotiations. So these negotiations have no value even from the Palestinian perspective, from the internal Palestinian perspective. And regardless of the discussion when it comes to the negotiations, whether we accept them in principle or not, even those who sat down with the Israelis on the negotiating table speak about disappointment, a big disappointment from 17 years of negotiations. They are disappointed with the 17 years. So what is the new thing which we witness? Will anything new come out of these negotiations? Israel still behaves in an arrogant manner and is still oppressing and still has American and Western support, and Israel, of course, or the American and Western powers have no choice, but because of their weakness they must give more life and more support for the Israelis. And when it comes to the second event, which I spoke about, the American withdrawal from Iraq, of course, I'm speaking quickly to take advantage of the time, and we're in the holy month of Ramadan. The second event is the withdrawal from Iraq, the American withdrawal from Iraq. This means defeat, defeat for the Americans. Nobody in the American administration had the courage to go ahead and make a victory speech. The speech which was made is more close to a speech of defeat. It spoke about just justifications for the withdrawal. Even when some of them spoke about an achievement, they spoke about mild, small achievements. We all know that the Americans came to Iraq for the sake of staying in Iraq and for controlling Iraq, for the sake of hegemony, not for the sake of leaving Iraq years after, but they were surprised. The Americans believed, and they spoke about mistakes, great, huge mistakes, huge strategic mistakes which were made in viewing the Iraqi scenario, in analyzing the Iraqi situation. They were very surprised with the resistance in Iraq, which began very quickly. And when I speak about the resistance in Iraq, and when people and when my Iraqi brothers are listening to me, I must distinguish, and I am completely sure that the Iraqi resistance means the jihadist heroic operations which target the occupying forces. However, when it comes to the operations which targeted the Iraqi people from all different religious sects, from all different races, from all factions of the Iraqi society, mosques, churches, ministries, marketplaces, such operations which target Iraqi people are criminal terrorist operations, are operations of ordered killings, are war crimes, and we cannot blend such operations in with the Iraqi resistance operations. The resistance, as I said, surprised the American occupation. The magnitude of the American losses were more than the American people could put up with and more than the American administration could put up with. The magnitude of spending to confront this resistance and to preserve the American military presence was more than the American budget could put up with and more than the American Treasury Department could put up with. And so the only choice for the Americans was to begin with the step-by-step withdrawal from Iraq. There is another very important second element, which is no less important than resistance, which is the perseverance of the Iraqi people, the patience and perseverance of the Iraqi people. For many years now, there are many elements, and there were many intelligence agencies which worked and which strived to make the Iraqis fight one another, to begin a sectarian war with one another, to begin with a sectarian division, a sectarian confrontation a racial confrontation. These efforts were pursued by intelligence agencies to begin with internal fighting between Arabs and Kurds, Kurds and Turkmens and Sunnis and Shias, etc., etc. And so here we must stop and salute the patience and the perseverance of the Iraqi people who can put up with all of these bombings which occurred, these horrific bombings which occur daily or on a near daily basis for many years without being dragged into internal conflicts, bombings which are accompanied by very, very harsh rhetoric and by harsh accusations and by media coverage which continue and increase the pains of the Iraqis. But in spite of all this, this Iraqi people, the oppressed Iraqi people, because of their vigilance and because of the guidance of the Iraqi religious clerics, because of the guidance of their Iraqi political leadership and because of the vigilance and the awareness of the Iraqi people, this conspiracy, the internal fighting did not occur. The Israeli intelligence, the American intelligence, they all have a role to play in the bombings which happened and will continue to happen in Iraq. Even with the those who support the Iraqi suicide, even the Iraqi suicide operations, the suicide operations which happened in Iraq, have the trace of American and Israeli intelligence. Look at the American and Israeli intelligence in Lebanon. If we have this American-Israeli intelligence activities in Lebanon, what can we say about Iraq? We have Mossad activities in Iraq. We all know that Israel has a red line. Its red line is that it doesn't want a unified Iraq, a stable Iraq, a strong Iraq, an Iraq which can stand as part of this ummah, as part of the causes of this ummah. And this is what everybody is waiting from Iraq. But this is a red line for Israel. Israel does not want Iraq to stand on its own two feet and to stand as an important part of this ummah. The Iraqi people have stood with perseverance in spite of the massacres. The Iraqi people were able to overcome the last period, the last stage. When the sectarian conflict does not work and when occupation becomes costly, there is hence no other choice for the occupiers except to withdraw. This is God's will. This is a historic will of God. This is the real alternative, whether it comes to Palestine or Lebanon or Iraq or Vietnam or any country in the world. The issue is not about a certain religion or a certain race or a certain civilization or a certain culture. Logic and God's will tells us that any country which is subject to occupation, even if the occupation forces are big occupation forces from a huge country, if the country under occupation has a people with the spirit of resistance and perseverance which brings together everything, there is no doubt that these people will be victorious and the occupiers will have to leave. What? Of course, even if the sacrifices of the resistance are huge sacrifices, what is going on in Iraq is a huge benefit for the choice of resistance as well. It benefits the choice of resistance, not any other choice. In between brackets, I would like to say as well that many of these groups which carry out suicide operations are attached or are related to intelligence agencies which have nothing to do with Islam, nor do they have anything to do with the Islamic plan in general, to the Islamic scheme. This is what happened in Pakistan, in Kuwait today. People who were protesting on Al-Quds Day in Pakistan, whereby 20,000 people or 20 million people have been forced to leave their homes, millions have suffered. Pakistan, which witnessed these floods. Now, in Pakistan, we saw people who protested to defend Palestine and Jerusalem Al-Quds and to defend Gaza. A suicide bomber comes and bombs himself up in these protests. Before I came into the studio, it was written 42 martyrs and more than 100 people were wounded in this suicide operation. These martyrs are the martyrs of Al-Quds, Jerusalem, the martyrs of Palestine. They are the martyrs of the super cause. However, the suicide bombers are the bombers of the devil, people who have been controlled by the devil, and they are being led and guided by intelligence agencies to carry out these suicide operations here and there. My dear brothers and sisters, yes, when we see today, when we take a look at the arena, there is no doubt that we are still in the center of the conflict and that there are many difficulties. In Palestine, we have a lot of difficulties. Even the resistance, which once again began in Palestine in the holy month of Ramadan in the West Bank. We have huge difficulties in Palestine, we have difficulties in Lebanon, we have difficulties in the region, we have difficulties in Iraq. But when we look from another angle, let's look in a more comprehensive manner. I would like to say, even as briefly as possible, that the resistive block, the block of resistance, which if we compare it to the other block, meaning the so-called Western bloc or the Israeli bloc, which also includes some so-called moderate Arab states, we cannot compare when it comes to magnitude or capabilities. We cannot compare these two blocks. I can say that the resistive bloc, the bloc of resistance in the last few years, in this last decade specifically, the resistive bloc was able to make a historic achievement, a huge historic achievement in the region. And this has repercussions on the international arena. This is in brief. After September 11, 2001, after the events of September 11, the neoconservatives came into power in the American administration and they had a certain plot for the region. America, which took the throne of the world and became the only superpower in the world after the collapse of the USSR, America gathered all of its powers in the whole world. It dismantled many of its military bases in the whole world and it focused its military bases in the Middle East, in our Arab and Islamic world, in our region where we have gas, where we have oil, where we have all of these natural resources. America came with a plot which was called the plot for the new Middle East, or a plan which was called the plan for a new Middle East. And this plan wanted to strengthen the Zionist entity, the Israeli entity, to strengthen it and to preserve it forever, forever politically, of course. It wanted to do this by imposing a humiliating settlement on the Palestinians and an Arab agreement to this settlement. This was a plan of the neoconservatives. They came with this plan to the region. They came with this plan which aimed to destroy the Palestinian resistance completely. Not just to destroy the armed resistance, but also to destroy the popular resistance, even to destroy political resistance, to destroy the cultural resistance. The neoconservatives wanted to make an Israeli-Palestinian settlement whereby anyone who would object to such a settlement would have his head cut off. They aimed to destroy the resistance in Lebanon so that Lebanon would also be part of the Israeli-Palestinian plot. They wanted to overthrow the resistive regime in Syria. They wanted to take control and practice hegemony over Iraq. And they didn't want any real will to be in the hearts of the Iraqi people. They wanted to isolate Iran and to destroy or make Iran collapse, and in the end to strike Iran and to overthrow the Islamic rule in Iran so that this whole region would be subject and would be vulnerable to the Israeli-American plot. This plot or this scheme, I would like to say that this scheme during the last 10 years had great capabilities which no previous scheme had in modern history, or in history totally. They had an army, they had a developed military machine, They had the so-called international community, but there is nothing called international community, of course. International community is America, and behind it, the world. They had money, they had economy, they also had the most dangerous and the most capable media capabilities after the revolution which we witnessed in the internet and the satellite communications. So they used their armies, they used their economy, and they used their psychological warfare, they used their international agents, intelligence agencies, for the sake of implementing their scheme. But for just for a few years, just during a few years, when they were confronted by the resistive bloc, and you know who this resistive bloc means, who it includes. I will begin. It includes Palestine, the resistance in Palestine, the resistance in Lebanon, Syria, Iran, the resistance in Iraq, and the rest of the political movements who support the resistance in the Arab world. They are, of course, small in number, but they have God on their side, and they have credibility on their side. And so if you want to evaluate the other side, the Israeli-American bloc, the scheme or project of this bloc has failed. This does not mean that the conflict has ended, but it means that we have entered into a new kind of conflict, into a new kind of confrontation. However, the project of the Americans and Israelis has failed, has retreated, and it will witness more failures and more defeats. Look at the military repercussions, look at the security repercussions, the political repercussions, look at the economic and financial repercussions, the repercussions on America and on Europe. And all of the experts, all of the economic strategic experts, all of them agree that all of the attempts to address the financial and economic crises in America and Europe will fail. And in the next few years, we will witness greater developments in this perspective. America today is not capable. It will not wage new wars because it's not capable of waging new wars, not because it is moderating its stance or changing its stance, not because it's reconsidering its stance towards human rights or the rights of people, not because it's reevaluating its moral status. No, the only reason America will not wage a war is because it has economic and social problems and an incapability because of the failure of its previous project, the previous project which it planned to implement on this region. Why did the resistive bloc achieve success, and why did the other bloc achieve failure? We achieved success because of the perseverance of the Palestinian people, the Palestinian resistance, especially in Gaza, the perseverance of the Lebanese resistance, especially in July 2006 war, and the perseverance of the Lebanese will in Lebanon, and the fact that the Lebanese did not deter to the American dictations. The perseverance of Syria, the perseverance of Iran, the perseverance of the Iraqi people and the Iraqi resistance, and all of these movements, all of these factions who showed perseverance were able to make this achievement possible. Today we are called upon to continue with this perseverance. Today we are called upon to continue with this stance of resistance. Today we feel, in spite of the difficulties, we have many difficulties in more than one arena, but these difficulties are details when we look at the comprehensive situation. We feel that we are approaching victory more than any time before. If we look at Israel today, Israel in the year 2010, is it the same as Israel on the eve of July 2006? July 2006, is it the same as Israel before the war on Gaza? Is it the same as Israel on the eve of the 25th of May 2000 when it withdrew from most of the territories in Lebanon? Of course, Israel in 2010 is different than Israel before. The super Israel, the greater Israel, has ended. This has left, is no longer in the world scene. Israel is now living a crisis, is now witnessing many challenges. Today we are called upon to continue with this perseverance and continue with our stance of resistance and continue to stand unified shoulder to shoulder. And we are concerned more than ever before to support and to provide support for the Palestinian people and for the Palestinian resistance. And when our brothers in Hamas carried out the last two military operations in the West Bank, they need every single voice in the Arab and Islamic world to bless such an operation, which was condemned by Barack Obama and which was condemned by the British and by Netanyahu and by others. Any kind of moral support for the resistance, any kind of financial support for the resistance must continue, because the best way to liberate Al-Quds and to liberate Palestine is by resistance. And here I would like to begin with the second part of my speech. I would like to speak about certain Lebanese issues which are related to what I said before. We in Lebanon, we always stress on the formula. Of course, those who are convinced with this formula, they call it a golden formula. The formula of the army, people and resistance in Lebanon. In every part of the formula, I'd like to speak about a certain topic, and as briefly as possible. First of all, I'd like to speak about the resistance part of the formula. I have 2 points in this part. The first point, just a few days ago, we had the 31st of August, the anniversary of the kidnapping of Imam Musa al-Sadr. May God bring him back to us. The anniversary of his kidnapping and the kidnapping of his two colleagues, Sheikh Muhammad Yaqub and Sayyid Abbas Badruddin. Imam Musa al-Sadr is the Imam of the resistance. This is one of the very important points which Hezbollah and the Amal movement agree to. We all view Imam Musa al-Sadr as the Imam of the resistance, the founding father of the resistance. We also view him as the father and the leader of us all. We believe that Imam Musa al-Sadr put us on this path. And Imam Musa al-Sadr pointed to us and looked at us and pointed to Al-Quds, and he taught us how to love Jerusalem, Al-Quds. And he also taught us how to fight on the road to Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and he taught us how to fall as martyrs on our way to Jerusalem, Al-Quds. We all know that Imam Musa al-Sadr and his two colleagues were the guests of the Libyan regime, and that they were taken as detainees in Libya. And in this perspective, the Lebanese Parliament Speaker, our colleague Nabih Birri, made a speech a few days ago, and he spoke in detail about this issue. Today, I don't want to repeat what Parliament Speaker Birri said, but I would like to stress and highlight on every single word which was said by Speaker Birri when it comes to this issue, whether it be on the judiciary level or on the political level. On the judicial level, the Lebanese judiciary must take its responsibility. For Lebanese civilians or from Lebanese leaders, I must say, who were kidnapped and taken as detainees in an Arab country, and we never did. Even the last few years, all of those who consider themselves as people who are concerned with the cause of Imam Musa al-Sadr, of course, first and foremost, the family of Imam Musa al-Sadr. All of our colleagues, we never went to the chance, or we never went to the choice of an international tribunal, because we all know an international tribunal in a world such as the world of today take a few millions of dollars and don't do anything. Of course, this proposal was made to Parliament Speaker Birri and was made to the family of Imam Musa al-Sadr. They made this proposal to address the issue of Imam Musa al-Sadr with millions of dollars at an international tribunal, but we do not sell just our leaders, we don't sell even our children for millions of dollars. We won't go to an international tribunal. We won't go to an international investigation into the issue of Imam Musa al-Sadr, because we know how such a tribunal will be managed. We know how such an investigation will be conducted. So the family of Imam Musa al-Sadr resorted to the Lebanese judiciary, the national judiciary. The Lebanese judiciary must take its responsibility regarding the details which were mentioned by Paolo Zvika Birri just a few days ago. Also on the political level, we strongly support the call for boycotting any Arab League summit in Libya. In the last Arab League summit, some people argued in the cabinet, in the ministry, and they decided that a Lebanese ambassador could go and participate. What did this participation give? How did it benefit the cause of Imam Musa al-Sadr? So when it comes to the Imam of the resistance, I say that we have the same stance when it comes to the judiciary level and the political level, and we have one word to say. Imam Musa al-Sadr and his colleagues are alive and detained in Libya, and they must be freed, and they must return to the arena of jihad and must return to their families. Full stop. We are not looking for settlements, nor are we looking for deals. We cannot neglect this issue, nor can we forget this issue, nor can this cause be lost. And at the same time, we want our colleagues to come back to their country, and we don't want to enter into a confrontation with anyone. We only want them to come back. The second main point when it comes to the resistance is the international investigation, the International Tribunal into the assassination of former Lebanese Premier Rafiq Hariri. I just have a few words to say. We said a few weeks ago, we said that we feel that the resistance is being targeted by this international investigation. We raised a few ideas. We also displayed evidence. The international prosecutor commented on the evidence which we made. Of course, it's good. The prosecutor Belmar has spoken. He hadn't spoken before. He's said a few words now. And what prosecutor Belmar said, he said that this evidence is limited or incomplete, and Hezbollah must give us more and must complete the evidence. What I want to say is the following. We are not concerned with the international investigation nor with the international tribunal. We are not concerned in answering the questions or answering the requests made by the prosecutor of the International Tribunal. I have written these words because they are sensitive. We gave what is in our possession. We gave this evidence to the Lebanese judiciary based upon the requests of the Lebanese judiciary. And once again, if the Lebanese judiciary has any questions and wants to follow up anything which is related to the Lebanese judiciary, anything related to the Lebanese judiciary and investigation wants to carry out, we are ready. However, if the Lebanese judiciary only has a role of a postman, whereby the Lebanese judiciary takes information we have and transfers this information to the International Tribunal, we are not ready, because, as I said, we are not concerned with providing anything to the International Tribunal or the International Prosecutor. If the Lebanese judiciary is concerned with this information and with investigating with the spies and with the false witnesses, and this is a duty of the Lebanese judiciary, hence then we are ready to cooperate fully. If the international prosecutor is concerned with the evidence which we gave, that's his business. But his concern or his non-concern will show or will be a big signal whereby we will evaluate the behavior of the international prosecutor and the international tribunal. So how he reacts to the evidence we gave will be a big signal and will show a lot how we evaluate the international prosecutor and his behavior. The second part of a formula, of course, is the army. We all support the call for arming the Lebanese national military and providing the Lebanese national military with the appropriate capabilities in order for this military to defend the Lebanese sovereignty and the Lebanese land and Lebanese people. And we hope that this file will go on the right road. We hope that we are not just satisfied with slogans and enthusiastic words. We hope that this road goes to implementation. We made a proposal in public and in the cabinet. Once again, we call on the Lebanese cabinet to put together delegations to request Arab assistance, Arab military assistance. Some said, no, we don't want Arab military assistance. We want to arm the military by our own Lebanese budget. But where is this budget? You said they don't have any money. Where can we get the money? When we look for the easy way, what I'm afraid of, I'm afraid that some people say we don't want assistance from anyone. We want to get money and from the Lebanese people to arm the Lebanese military. Then the Lebanese would say the Lebanese people cannot put up with more taxes and more revenues. And so because we refuse taxes, then they would accuse us of not wanting to arm the Lebanese military. I hope that the issue of arming the Lebanese military is a serious national, moral, honest issue, which is far away from any politicization and from any political competition, which we find sometimes to be dirty competition, actually. So put this issue aside, put it outside of politicization and political competition. It's their duty to support us. Lebanon made the head of the Arab Ummah hang high. Because of Lebanon, every Arab person can be proud of his Arab identity. So it's their duty, it's the duty of the Arabs to help us and to assist our Lebanese military. And so put delegations together and we will call on them to give us some of these weapons in these weapons depots. What are the Americans giving to us? Forget the weapons they are giving us, which are 20 or 30 years old. What else are the Americans giving us? And we said also, we said that we are ready and we are ready to use our relations with Iran. The Iranians announced that they are ready to help Lebanon based upon the Lebanese government's request, based upon an official Lebanese request. They said if the Lebanese express readiness and make an official request and say we need X, Y, and Z of weapons, the Iranians, our colleagues in Iran are ready. So it must be an official request made by the Lebanese government. What is funny is that Lebanon, which was subject to American conditions for arming the Lebanese military, the Americans put conditions on arming the Lebanese military. When we spoke about Iran arming the Lebanese military, some put conditions on Iran for arming the Lebanese military. They said we accept the Iranian assistance, but based upon conditions. If this condition is for the assistance to be unconditional, we accept. But some people are starting to put conditions. There is one person who said, we agree for this Iranian assistance with the condition that the Iranians stop their assistance for the Lebanese resistance. Can you believe that? Now the Lebanese government has a chance. The Iranian government announced its readiness. The Iranian President Dr. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad will be in Lebanon in a few weeks. So let's be ready for a clear, honest discussion about arming the Lebanese military. The third part of the formula is the people. When I speak about the people in Lebanon, let's say the Lebanese people and the Palestinian refugees who are our beloved ones in the Lebanese territory. So I'd like to speak about two quick points here, and I think it's necessary to speak about them. The first point, what happened in Burj Abu Haydar, the shooting which occurred in Burj Abu Haydar. This incident which occurred, we of course released a statement with the Mashari'a group. We said this is an unfortunate incident. I'm repeating this, and these are my feelings and the feelings of all of my colleagues. It was a very painful incident. I said at that time it was not two martyrs who fell, but three martyrs who fell in this shooting in Burj Abu Haydar. What happened in Burj Abu Haydar does not need any overreaction, because it's clear what happened. It's a loss for all sides. There is no win from whatever angle you look at it. Some people try to make some analysis to look at the benefits, but there are no benefits for anyone. This is a loss. What happened in Burj Abu Haydar is a loss from the humanitarian, moral, political, security, human, any perspective whatsoever. It was a loss. I would like to also stress to you that this was an individual issue which developed. It was an individual disagreement which further developed. It had no background. All of the political analysis which you heard had no meaning whatsoever. Some considered Burj Abu Haidar to be an incident which reflects an Iranian-Syrian conflict. These people are people who don't know how to think, those people who analyze in this way, who think it's an Iranian-Syrian conflict, because they are tools in a big scene, in a big scenario. They are small tools, and for this reason they speak in this way. The big project has lost, so they have nothing to depend on. So what do they depend on? Do they depend on the Americans who are withdrawing, who are leaving, who are going bankrupt? Do they depend on the Israelis and an Israeli war, a war which Israel calculates hundreds of times before it has the courage to launch on Lebanon? Whom do they depend on? Do they depend on enmity with Syria? Yes, they have the issue of the international tribunal, the international investigation, and I believe we will be able to confront this. So what's left for them? They are waiting for this bloc which was able to achieve a victory in the most dangerous historic conflict, the conflict of the neoconservatives. We who were able to achieve success against this conflict, they believe that they could defeat us now when they have weakened. Sometimes they speak about a Syrian-Iranian disagreement, but I'd like to tell you the Syrian-Iranian relations are stronger than they were any time before. Why? Because this Syrian-Iranian alliance has proved its benefits, has proved its efficiency. Were it not for the Syrian-Iranian alliance, Al-Quds Jerusalem would have been lost, Israel would have been preserved, and the project of the other bloc would have been victorious. The Syrian-Iranian alliance now is stronger and more faithful in the necessity and the righteousness of this alliance. The relation between the Syria and resistance, some small kids are trying to play and say that there are disagreements in the Syrian relation with the resistance. But I'd like to tell you, ever since the history of the founding of the resistance in Lebanon, never was the alliance so strong as it is today between the Lebanese resistance and Syria. So let them look for another way to speak about divisions. Let them calm down. There are no disagreements between Iran and Syria, nor between the resistance in Syria. If they want to dream about this in their sleep, they can dream. But what I'd like to comment on when it comes to Burj Abu Haidar is the following. First of all, this issue was magnified in the media. Even we, in the first hours and in the second day, we were still astonished by the incident. But when we went down to the street and when we put together committees to investigate, and when the Lebanese army conducted an investigation, of course what happened was not small, but it wasn't as big as the media spoke about or as the media showed. Always before the investigation is made, preemptive judgments are heard. Some people in Lebanon, just like what happened with the assassination of Premier Rafiq Hariri, after 1 year, 1 hour of Rafiq Hariri's assassination, they investigated and they put people in prison without any investigation, without anything whatsoever, without any proof. You must be patient. In Burj Abu Haidar, for example, investigations were conducted, and so number one, the issue was magnified and put out of proportion, and number two, how they took advantage of this incident in Burj Abu Haidar. We were silent the first day, the second day, the third day. We were silent because we are feeling pain. We and our colleagues in the Ahbash or in the Mashari' group, we in the resistance, we know the magnitude of the loss. But on the other hand, how did they react? I'm not speaking about statesmen or others. We're speaking as Lebanese, as partners, as political leaders. And there's a least extent which judges the relations between us. So the incident was taken out of proportion and they took advantage of this incident. And the message was given the media, many different sides and personnel and politicians, instead of the whole world, instead of all of them going and putting out the fire, they tried to increase the fire, they tried to increase the blaze. Instead of looking at this issue as an issue which is very dangerous, as we and the Masharia viewed it, and we and the opposition viewed it, we viewed that this was a very dangerous issue which we must address, especially when it comes to the sectarian issue. And so instead of putting out the blaze, they put more fire on the blaze. They increased the fire. This is a dangerous way to take advantage of such an incident. An extremely dangerous way of taking advantage of the incident. What happened threatens security, does not protect security, threatens civil peace, does not protect civil peace. I would like to express my feelings in this regard. For those who made mistakes after the incident of Burj Abu Haydar and who didn't address this issue, some of them we won't comment on, but we comment on others. I would like to say, you didn't come and put salt in the wound to seal the wound. From Tuesday until now, we are still hurt. You came and put a salt on the knife and put your knife in our heart. Let you know what you did. I'd like to let you know what you did. It's not in this way whereby you address dangerous issues. This is not how statesmen behave, nor is it how politicians behave, nor is it how leaders of political parties behave. This is our evaluation. In addition, from the first moments we said that the Lebanese, the police, the Lebanese judiciary must conduct investigations and let all the measures take place, and we will all cooperate, and nobody wants to cover up for anyone, because this is a loss for all sides. As the fathers of the martyrs said, this is very dangerous, and it puts in danger the sectarian coexistence. The last point which I'd like to say is that there is a wrong way of behavior, not just in this issue, in all issues in the region. An incident takes place, an incident occurs, we take this incident to open a huge file, and we know that we can't address this file, or we can't address this matter. For example, the issue of arms in Lebanon and the spreading of arms in Lebanon. Every house in Lebanon has arms, not just Hezbollah, not just the Masharia, nor any specific party. All houses in Lebanon have arms. Some houses have RPG missiles and rocket launchers, and some houses have even bigger weapons. I'm not speaking about political parties, I'm speaking about homes, houses. This goes back to the 1970s or 60s. For a long time, we have a complex issue in Lebanon, which is the issue of arms. Before many of us were born, this issue has become more complex and became more complex in the Lebanese Civil War. And it became more complex when Israel invaded Lebanon and after Israel's war on Lebanon. Such a complex issue, which is attached to regional matters, whether it be the Palestinian or Lebanese arms, such an issue needs wisdom and needs time. But what did they do? They took advantage of the Burj Abu Haydar incident to solve the issue of the arms. And let's take decisions regarding the arms. This is wrong. We can't address the issue of arms, which is tens of years old, in 1 hour or in 1 day. This is not how you address the issue of the arms, nor do you address the issue of electricity in this matter, nor we address the political reforms in this matter. This is a wrong way to behave. I just have a few more minutes. Let me speak here in a popular way. Previously, we had a manual steering wheel for the cars, whereby the driver had to put in more effort to turn, and when a rock came under the tire, the driver was still able to control the car. Now we have a different steering wheel whereby a small rock makes the car turn around. I find that the political administration in Lebanon has a modern steering wheel whereby it can easily turn off course. Any incident makes it turn left, another incident makes it go straight or right. It's all reactions. So for the sake of not complaining, I call for a period of calm. The things have taken their toll, and some people want to continue with the harsh rhetoric. That's their business. Now I want to conclude. I want to announce a unilateral initiative. I haven't made an agreement with anyone, but I want to announce a unilateral initiative. The investigation has been conducted, and we, with the people of the Mashari'a, are, of course, we have addressed the issue, and now I want to unilaterally announce a period of calm after what happened in Burj Abu Haydar, because these people want to continue with living with one another. Nobody wants to cancel out the other, nobody wants to overcome the other, and nobody does not recognize the other. We all recognize each other. So let's sit down and reach an understanding. Let's find out a way to manage the country. We must work, and we must drive with an old steering wheel, a manual steering wheel, not an oil steering wheel. So the government must work in a way where it does not only react to what happens on the ground. The last point which I want to make is regarding the Palestinians and the rights of the Palestinians. With the same frankness I spoke of before, allow me to say that the comparison which was made, or the developments which occurred regarding the Palestinian rights, this needs more discussion. The Palestinian rights, or the rights of Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, the rights of Palestinian refugees in Lebanon was always a firm point in the speeches of Al-Quds Day. For me, ever since 1992, we always spoke about it. It's 60 or 62 years old, this issue of the rights of Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. Actually, I found lately that we got preoccupied in other issues, and time was against us, and we were called upon to adopt certain laws. And so when fears are expressed and when political competition is made, the result of a certain topic becomes Palestinian rights, or rights of Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. This hasn't satisfied the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. Yes, the formula reached didn't satisfy the Palestinian refugees. But how do we address this? First of all, I say we must put it on the path of a solution. How? A Lebanese group must be formed. A Lebanese committee must be formed. This could be formed by Hezbollah, the Amal movement, the Progressive Socialist Party. Any side, any group could volunteer and say, we as a Lebanese party, we want to form a committee. We want to form a committee to meet with the Palestinians in Lebanon, or even a Palestinian committee could be formed to shed light. Who is afraid? Who is afraid from giving civil rights to the Palestinian refugees? Who is afraid? And they have legitimate concerns, of course. Those sides who are afraid, they have legitimate concerns. Of course, sometimes we have racial expressions and we condemn this, but others have legitimate concerns from giving Palestinian refugees their natural rights. So let them sit down with them. Let's have a committee formed which sits down with these people who have these legitimate concerns, and let's see what these concerns are. Of course, after what happened in the parliament, this was good, but we need more steps to be taken. Let's have a joint Palestinian-Lebanese discussion, far away from the media, far away from politicization. Let's have a serious discussion whereby the fears are expressed on the table, and how we can blend in, how we can satisfy the fears of those who have concerns and satisfy at the same time the rights of the Palestinians who aspire to have legitimate rights. At this time, my dear brothers and sisters, we in the resistance in Lebanon, we feel that we are on the right side of the victorious bloc. Now, in 2010, after 62 years, we are closer than ever before from Jerusalem. We are closer than ever before to Jerusalem al-Quds. Time, it's only a matter of time between us and the Israeli entity. This entity, according to the sanctities and to religion and according to the rules of conflict, this entity's destiny is defeat, is an end. The patience and perseverance and the sacrifices of the Palestinian people who have put up with all of this for 62 years and have not deterred and are not ready to back down from their rights and from their sanctities and from their territories. This is an element of strength which they always depend on to decide the end, the result of the conflict. Of course, a happy Al-Quds Day and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.